you recall, the whole purpose of the Bria is basically only for one reason. And that is that the Rabbeinu Shalom wanted to be mative Zulosoi, which means that the Rabbeinu Shalom wants to impart or bestow the good that he has, he wants to give it to others. Therefore, he creates other beings in order to receive it. That's the whole tachas of the Bria. That's the entire rationale why the Bria was created, so that he could have beings which could receive the goodness that he wants to give them. That's the most basic reason of all. Now, in addition, we know that since the Rabbeinu Shalom is perfect, therefore whatever he does is always perfect. So therefore this Aimida of Shlemus would mean that if he wants to do good, it's going to be also with Shlemus. In other words, if he wants to be a mative, if he wants to give Hatova, goodness, pleasure, whatever that is, then that has to be B'Shlemus also. So therefore we arrive at the concept called Hatova Shlemo, which means that whatever the Rabbeinu Shalom of course does is going to be perfect, and since he wants to give, that's what he wants to do, that's his Ratzon. Therefore obviously that's also going to be B'Shlemus. So therefore the next idea is Hatova Shlemo. Now besides, the idea of Hatova Shlemo of course indicates certain things or determines certain kinds of ideas. One of them is the fact that the reward, or rather the toiv, the pleasure that people will get, of course, will be the greatest kind of pleasure. And it follows that since the pleasure or the toiv that the Rabbeinu Shalom has is the greatest of all, since it is perfect, so therefore it follows therefore that the toiv which people will experience will be some attribute or some aspect of the Rabbeinu Shalom. This is what it follows. So we say that God is Olam Haba, and that the idea of a person in Olam Haba is what's called Dveikus. Dveikus is a term which is used to indicate a person's nearness or closeness to the Rabbeinu Shalom. Dveikus literally means clinging, attachment, dovak. And the idea of dveikus is that one being is in very close proximity, physically, to another. That's the idea of dveikus. The idea of dveikus itself is basically a metaphor. When something clings to something else physically, what does it really mean? It means that the thing is also in an intimate relationship with the object that it's attached to or clinging to. So therefore, dveikus really means an intimate relationship that one being has with another being. Okay? That's the second idea of dveikus. The first idea is the actual physical attachment. That itself is really an expression or a metaphor that when a person is physically attached to something else, what you're really seeing here is an intimate relationship on some level between the two objects that are in the state of dveikus or physical attachment. What really happens in the dveikus? The idea of an intimate relationship means that one object experiences the other object, or rather each object is experiencing them each other in a very close state of experience, and therefore one object knows the other object in a very intimate way. So when a person is in dveikus with the Rabbeinu Shalom, what it really means is that he experiences a great sense of the Rabbeinu Shalom as the source of his being. He experiences the Rabbeinu Shalom as a sherish. He can feel the Rabbeinu Shalom from within him. Dveikus is the experience where an individual clings to the Rabbeinu Shalom, thereby achieving an intimate relationship with the Rabbeinu Shalom, which really means that he feels, he's margish. He experiences the Rabbeinu Shalom himself in himself. He experiences the Rabbeinu Shalom as his shirish, as his source. He feels the Rebbeinu Shlom within him. But there are further ideas in Dvekas. Besides the fact that the individual is physically in contact, and that is only a metaphor for the Rebbeinu Shlom, so therefore what it really means, of course, is that there's an intimate relationship, which means that you actually experience the Rebbeinu Shlom from within as a source and a shirish. This is what we're saying so far, what Dvekas really is. Besides, what you experience, when you experience the Rebbeinu Shlom from within, you, in other words, you are experiencing his metzius, correct? But by the same token, you're also experiencing a lack of your metzius. In other words, what you metzius, your being, your existence. As you begin experiencing the existence of the Rebbeinu Shlom as a source, you begin to be magish that part of your being lies within the Rebbeinu Shlom. So therefore, you're beginning to experience what's called his Eineg Mevadoi aspect, the fact that he is the only thing that exists. And the more you experience the Rebbeinu Shlom, the more you experience the fact that you really lie within him. In other words, more and more of you becomes him, which of course is Eineg Mevadoi. That's what you begin to feel. So Dvekas ultimately is the Hasuga of Eineg Mevadoi. You see the way it works. By the intimate relationship indicates, or the connotation of that, is that you experience the Rebbeinu Shlom in terms of his metzius, his shirish, as a shirish, as a source, and then you experience the fact that you are less, because he obviously is taking more and more of you, so therefore you are becoming less and less. So it's the Hasog Yehude that's part of the idea of Dvekas. Now, as you experience more and more of the Rebbeinu Shlom, right, and he's taking up more and more of you, you are also experiencing more and more of his Shlemus, his perfection. In other words, you are becoming more perfect because you are becoming more he. Since the Rebbeinu Shlom is a Sholem, is that kind of being which is completely perfect, you therefore, as experiencing the Rebbeinu Shlom more and more, are not only experiencing yourself less and less in that sense, but you're also experiencing more Shlemus, because you're experiencing more of the Rebbeinu Shlom. So by your attachment to the Rebbeinu Shlom, you are being mishtalim, you are being perfected, you see. That's the way to come to true Shlemus or perfection in terms of existence, by attaching oneself or coming in contact with, within the Rebbeinu Shlom who is perfect. So it comes out that you are becoming mishtali, means you are becoming more and more perfected. So therefore, Dvekas is the same idea as Shlemus, because it leads really to the same thing. As you are becoming more and more mishtali, more and more perfect, because you are becoming more and more in contact with him, you are experiencing incredible amount of pleasure that comes with that experiencing of Shlemus. So we see that the notion of Dvekas is really the same idea of being Masig the Rebbeinu Shlom, okay, as the shirish and source of yourself, which is really the same idea of being Masig Yehudoi of the Rebbeinu Shlom, which is really the same idea as being Masig or being Margush or experiencing Toiv, tremendous pleasure or good. It's all the same thing. I'm just merely building it up, you know, showing how one emanates from the other. And that complete state whereby one feels this, the Rebbeinu Shlom as a shirish, a source, the aspect of Yehudoi, right, Yehud Mitziusoi, and the aspect of the pleasure and the aspect of the Shlemus, all these ideas, all these things are called Dvekas. That's what's meant by the idea of Dvekas. So when it says, V'dov kaboy, uvoy sidvak, and in him shall you cling, right, V'dov kaboy and shall cling to him, that is the idea of Dvekas, to become as much as possible as attached to the Rebbeinu Shlom himself. And that is the end-all state in Olam Haba, Dvekas. And that is the greatest state of all. Now, in Olam Hazeh, the state of Dvekas is experienced as somewhat differently. It's experienced as a state in intense longing for the Rebbeinu Shlom. Dvekis is experienced in that way as an intense longing for the Ribbono Shel Olam. In other words, the best example is that tzaddikim don't have to think about God. They can't think about anything else. That's really the way it works, you know? And a very good comparison is really the love relationship that can exist between a man and woman. And there are many repercussions as a result of that, you know? You feel two people who meet each other and they get to know each other and so on, and what's commonly called, they fall in love with each other, whatever, you know? But the idea, what that really means is that after a while, both persons begin thinking of each other rather frequently. And as the relationship grows more and more, then it's very hard to get the person out of your mind. It gets that intense. Okay? That is the same idea, that ahava, that love, that forces you to think of the other individual. And it's not a tircha, it's not a difficulty thinking about the other individual. On the contrary, it's an intensely pleasurable act. And it's almost impossible to get the other person out of your mind. It's the same idea with the Ribbono Shel Olam, that ahava. The same idea that the dvekis that tzaddikim are margish is that they cannot get the Ribbono Shel Olam out of their minds. That what exists in their mind is a true yearning, constantly an awesome yearning for the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in Olam Hazeh, that yearning, that love for the Ribbono Shel Olam, and therefore the yearning, and the inability to get the Ribbono Shel Olam out of the mind becomes painful to a certain extent. Because you can't have the Ribbono Shel Olam as much as you want him. So therefore the experience becomes painful in a certain way. So the true dvekis of a tzaddik, I'm really defining the true dvekis of a tzaddik, so now you know. When we say a tzaddik is a dovek, what does that really mean? This is what it means. It means that the tzaddik yearns for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Okay? The same way a man and a woman would yearn for each other. That it's the same murdik ahava. That the idea that the people can't get themselves out of each other's mind, it's not difficult to keep them in the mind. They can't get them each other out of the mind. The tzaddik can't get the Ribbono Shel Olam out of the mind. Okay? And as such, there's a certain pain associated with it. But it's like a pleasure-pain kind of thing. You know, it's a pain that comes from such intense pleasure and the fact that you can't get more pleasure in that sense. This is what dvekis really is. And what a person can be masig in this world. A person can reach that level of dvekis here, where he can get such an incredible ahava for the Rosham that he can't get the Rosham out of his mind. It becomes the only object worth existing for. And the person yearns, and if he can't have the Ribbono Shel Olam, then it's lama lichayim, it's not worth existing. That's the idea of dvekis in this world. Of course, in Olam Haba, you have the Ribbono Shel Olam in that sense. You know, it's not the yearning, but the Ribbono Shel Olam does become part of you in that sense. So the ahava becomes complete in that sense. You know, you actually have the object of love, and there's no other object at all that's replaced. But in Olam HaZeh, unfortunately, a great deal of the dvekis that tzaddikim feel or margish is yearning, because it can't have the Ribbono Shel Olam completely. That's why you come to the peculiar phenomena called the misa of tzaddikim. Tzaddikim who die as a result of the ahava of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Like Ben Azai. Ben Azai went into the Pardes. Chazal say that four people went into a Pardes. They went into a grove, which is a metaphor really, they went into Chochmah. Rabbi Akiva, Ben Azai, and Acher, Rishon Habuya, and Ben Zema. And four different things happened to each one of them. What happened to Ben Azai is Ben Azai died. So why Ben Azai died? Because the reason why Ben Azai died because he was masik so much in thinking about God, that he just couldn't take it. That the bounds of the body broke. And he died out of love. It's a true death out of love. Okay? In other words, the neshama, it was such a yearning for the Ribbono Shel Olam that Ben Azai just died. That's how much dvekis he had. He couldn't be contained within the body. And you find the same thing that happened by Matan Torah when God presented himself to the Jews and he gave the first two commandments. He gave them, not Moshe Rabbeinu. Everybody died. Why did they die? They all died because the ava of the neshama at that point was so great, because the Roshim is mamash communicating directly, that they just broke the bonds of the body and they flew back to the Roshim. It was a love of, it was a death of love. It wasn't a death because of fright. That's how great the ava was. Once the Roshim is megal himself to people, so they all died. So of course the Roshim had to resurrect them, or else they'll be all just dead eaten and so on, you know. But again, the same notion that people can die in such a state of ava, that's how great. And they used to, they once, Maisa was sadik, that they used to say, don't, you know, when he used to go into himself, you have to shake him every once in a while. Or you didn't shake him, you know, you prayed, who knows where he'd go, you know. So once they forgot to shake him, they shook him, it was too late, he was dead, you know. And that's the same idea where the dvekas was so great that he died. Now for us to think of these things is very bizarre, it's very strange, because this is so far removed from the experience that normal people have. So that's why you have to look at it in terms of if a husband or a wife passes away, the same idea, you can only look at it in terms of that way. Alavai, everybody here should be zocha, not to go through the death of that, but to be magish, be so close, you know, that we have to worry about you. You know, I'm not saying you have to go through this, but you have to worry about you, you know. That's a peculiar phenomena that arises from dvekas. That the yearning is so great that if it's just too much yearning, the person actually can die. And you find that by tzaddikim, you find Ben Azai, you find about by the Jews at Har Sinai, that everybody died. That's the idea of death. And the interesting thing about it, you find also by Moshe Rabbeinu. It says Moshe Rabbeinu died with a neshika. Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron, Akoin, and Miriam all died by God's kissing them. The Sultan Malach HaMavis did not take them. That's what it says. They died what's called neshika, which means a kiss. The Rosham kissed them in that sense. So the question is, what does that mean? When God kissed them, because without a kiss, doesn't have a mouth. So at the end of it, you know, what does that mean? The idea of neshika. What form of death is that? That is the greatest death of all, neshika, and that's what they died. And the question is, why Taka did they die that way? Well, the answer after this becomes very obvious. What is neshika, kiss? Again, that's a metaphor. When two people are kissing each other, isn't that a tremendous, intense relationship or intimate relationship? Kissing merely indicates a very strong, intimate relationship between two people, right? So when the Rosh Hashanah kissed Moshe, what did he really do? He revealed himself to Moshe. He revealed himself to Moshe, and that's understood by the metaphor called kissing, because that's what happens in kissing, right? So he revealed himself to Moshe, and the power of the revelation of the Gilu was so great that Moshe Rabbeinu died, even though Moshe was accustomed to leaving his guf. Because you recall, Moshe used to leave his guf. He was Chatziyish, Chatzielokim, half man, half God, in the sense that he could leave his body whenever he wants. But there was a point where Moshe revealed himself so great that even the last vestige of connection separated. And that, of course, is the greatest of all. And when they say that tzaddikim, when they die, it's very painful. Not painful because death itself is hard. For tzaddikim, death is not. Chazal say that when a tzaddik dies, it's how painful it is, like taking a hair out of milk. That's the example Chazal used. Take hair out of milk. Whereas when a rasha dies, it's very painful. So it doesn't make sense. Why is it by one is so easy and the other is so difficult? If it was the actual state of death, it wouldn't make a difference. Who died? If death itself was a painful experience, right? It wouldn't make a difference who died. The experience itself is difficult. So why by a tzaddik is it so easy? Like taking a hair out of milk by a rosha, it's so painful, like pulling off his arms or something like that, yeah? The answer is obvious, because what makes death hard is not the death itself. It's your readiness to leave your body. By a Rasha is in no mood to go anywhere, because he wants his body. That's all he knows is Ilam Hazeh. So when the Mahamava says, let me give you Neshama, the Neshama doesn't want to go. So therefore, what's difficult is his resistance that's so painful. It's because the Rasha resists going that makes it so painful. But the Tzaddik doesn't want to be here in the first place. So he doesn't want to be in the body, right? So when the Mahamavis takes a tzaddik, he just right out. He doesn't need a second calling. He called me, wham, doesn't need a sec, another instant, and the tzaddik is gone. That's why it's easy, because the tzaddik is a foreigner in the body, whereas the rosh is a foreigner in Shemayim. And that's indicated by the here in the milk. The milk, the here is a foreign substance in the milk, right? So it's very easy to take it out. Not like separating milk from milk. It's separating the hair from milk. Because the tzaddik is really different than the body. He doesn't belong, he's foreign to the body. He wants ruchnius. That's why it's so easy to take the tzaddik. Whereas the rasha, who's so part of the guf, he's the one who makes it painful because he doesn't want to leave. It's like taking milk from milk. That's the difference, you see? So again, the idea that he who's dovek already is more there than he is here, you know. And also the idea of vekis, always you see the idea of vekis in terms of the clinging of natural parts together. You find, where do you find the lashon of vekis? You find the lashon of vekis by a man in the Rebbeinu Shlom, v'dov kaboy, and you also find it by a man and a woman. It says v'dovek ish v'ishtoy, a man will cling to his wife. Same lashon of vekis. So the question is, why do you have the lashon of vekis? Because the answer is that the clinging with a man and a woman together is a restoration of the original parts that were split. The same idea. When parts come together and reunite, that's called vekas. You see? And just like that's why the Torah uses it in Lashon of man and woman, because that's really what it is. It's an neshama that split. One became a male, the other became a female, in that sense. And the marriage of them together is really the restoration of that previous split. That's what they mean by the half. Better half, you know, and so on, you know, that's the idea of half. That's why the Torah uses the lashon vekis by an odom v'ishtoi, and the ish v'ishtoi, the same idea with the Rebbeinu Shlom. Since the neshama is a chelik l'kaim imal, the neshama is merely returning to the original whole, right? The mela, it's called vekis, again the same idea of vekis. Okay, let's discuss the idea of vekis. You know, it has, obviously, I've discussed it from a Hashkofa standpoint, what is Dvekas and so on. Of course it has, this could be used as a beautiful Musa Shmuz also and so on, you know. My idea is not to give Musa, it's merely to talk about phenomena. Sounds rather cold, but I'm merely here to talk about Dvekas and what Tzaddikim are Margish when they Mizvdavik. So we now understand, recall a couple of weeks ago we talked about the idea of Nachas Ruach, to bring Nachas Ruach to the Rebbeinu Shlom and so on. Now we understand what the whole idea of Vegas is, and so on. We get more and more a picture of a tzaddik, what really goes on in the mind of a real tzaddik. And we've come to certain conclusions. That the idea of Vegas, the idea of Hasoga, Yehudai, right? The idea of experiencing the Rebbeinu Shlom, and therefore Masig Yehudai. The idea of Shlemus, you having Shlemus. The idea of pleasure, all the same thing. It's all the same operation called Vekas. Then the idea that Vekas itself means in Elam Hazeh, an intense yearning. Okay? Intense yearning for the Rebbeinu Shlom. And it's very, you can't get the Rebbeinu Shlom out of your mind. Not that you have to think of him. Then the peculiar phenomena that arises for such an incredible Vekas is the idea of Vekas by death, or death because of Vekas. I illustrated different ideas, even by Hasina and Tzaddikim and Benazai and so on. And also the idea of the idea of what Neshike is, of Misa, of Moshe Rabbeinu, that form of death. And also why death is difficult, that's what comes out of it. And that they really died by incredible act of Vekas, that's why it's really painless and so on. And the last idea, of course, that the Lashon of Vekas is always indicates the restoration of two parts which originally were together and split. This is the idea so far of Vekas. This is what the Rebbeinu Shlom wants from people, right? He wants people to achieve a state of Vekas. That's what he wants. And that is the greatest state of all. That is the end-all state, Noilam Habrok. Now you can understand when Tzaddik Ba being Mizdabik, when people think that tzaddikim are going through tremendous yisurim and so on. But would you say that somebody who has a tremendous, two people in love with each other, that each one is being miyasa because somebody wants, Would you say that two people who are, you know, in love with each other, whatever, so the man, let's say he's going out and whatever he wants to buy, he's always thinking, well, this would be great for my wife, this would be great for my wife, or whatever, right? Would you say, Nebuch, this guy doesn't take anything for himself. He must be suffering. He's always fighting himself. Well, look, you know, he's got a self-interest. Why don't I buy something myself? Right? Would you say that there's a difficulty in Muhammad there? No. Because now you realize, you know, maybe before it sounded like it was a very difficult Muhammad. You always get your self-interest out and so on. But now you begin to realize that if you somehow can be Mizdabik and replace that with Ava, it's effortless. Because that's what happens in real life. In real life, you have couples who are really in love with each other. They're always trying to do something, they're always thinking about each other, trying to do something with each other, and they're always buying gifts for each other, and so on and so forth. You wouldn't say that these Nebuch people are suffering, they're always denying themselves. On the contrary, they say, you're crazy, that the greatest pleasure that they have is giving to each other. That is what Sadiqim reach. So now you begin to realize that Sadiqim do not have Yisurin by being an Oyved. The Avoider is the greatest pleasure of all. And they would fight you tooth and nail to take away the Avoider. That's the difference, you see? But now you can appreciate that if you've gone through all the different ideas and assume about what the Avoider is. Now you see the Avoider is effortless, and on the contrary, there would be incredible resistance not to be an Oyved. That's the idea that the Avoider is all about. The Avoider is, in the beginning, of course, the Avoider is to do it, and it's Shver, there's Melchoma. In the end, there is no Melchoma. The Melchoma is the reverse. Don't take it away. That's the Melchoma. So in other words, you've achieved such an incredible longing and yearning and union with the Rebbeinu Shalom that there's nothing else you would want to do. That's the Avoider, is to put that in the mind of a Jew. Once a person has reached that madrega, then he has completely fulfilled what he has to do. Because the idea of the mitzvah is not only a quantity, you do one mitzvah and then you add another mitzvah. What it is to change the mind, the attitude of the individual, in which the individual has a murdik ava for the Rebbeinu Shalom, then the avodah is a different thing altogether. It's a pleasure to do the avodah. There's no more naam and iksufu, because on the contrary, you're giving him. You know, you're not receiving, you don't want, you are going, it's like, the idea of the man and woman. His greatest pleasure is giving the other one pleasure and seeing the other person's face light up, right? So, you know, who's on the receiving end and so on, you know? That's the same idea. Namlik Sufa ceases to exist as a result of this relationship between a person and the Rebbeinu Shalom. That the Ava is so great that anything he can give the Rebbeinu Shalom makes him happy. And if God is happy because I receive from him, so then let me give him right back. So you've come into a circular motion where you get from God and you give it right back to the Rosh and make him happy. He gives you again and you give right back to the Rosh and make him happy. So you come back into this circular kind of motion, okay, where you are merely receiving in order to give it away. And of course it's always because of your Bechira, so merely there's tremendous potency and there's no Namalik Sufa, because you're always giving. Okay, so the idea of Dveikus sort of like finishes the idea of Namalik Sufa, but now you see the different stamp on it. Not that Avodah is a difficult thing, it becomes a completely romantic kind of thing. It becomes a desirable thing to pursue. Not something to run away, where it becomes an Avodah, like a labor. It's a hard labor to do, you know? On the contrary, the greatest desirable thing of all, you know? And don't feel sorry for tzaddikim. Feel sorry for yourselves. Now, once the Rebbeinu Shalom had decided that this is what he wants, he now will go about creating Olam Hazeh. But the idea is in Olam Hazeh, what happens in Olam Hazeh? Or rather, what are the conditions necessary for this Olam Hazeh? Well, Olam Hazeh needs several conditions. It needs basically six conditions. And then we can make Olam Hazeh. The first thing is there has to be a Nivra. There has to be a being that will receive the Toiv of the Rebbeinu Shalom. So, the first thing that this Bria needs, in general, from the standpoint of the universe, the creation needs a being that can receive the Rebbeinu Shalom's Toiv. It has to be that kind of being. Then he's a Nivra. Okay, that Nivra obviously is man. Okay? Mankind, that is obviously the Nivra. And everybody else, I don't care if that being is higher than man because he's a Malach, or he's lower than man because he's animals or whatever. All other beings merely assist man in getting him to his tachlas. That's all they are there for. They are merely there for assistance sake. Man is the pivot of the Bria and the focal point in the Merkaz. Everything revolves around man, okay? And the whole idea, everything tries to assist him in getting him there. That's the whole point of it all. So that Nivra is man, and everybody is assisting him. And the universe could be created for one man, remember, not for two. That's how great the Odom is. One individual can justify all of creation, which is really an incredible idea. That shows the chashivas, the importance, the significance, the worth of one human being. Because it says, Odom, because Bereshit created Odom Harishon, only one man. I mean, the universe was justified for the creation only of one man and no more. Okay, so it needs a Nivra, right? First condition. Well, the second thing, it needs a task. This man's got to do a job. Why does he have to do a job? Because again, we say that the Russian wants to give somebody an Avoida, that he should merit the Torah that the Russian is going to give him. So God obviously has to give him a job to do. He needs a task, right? But wait a minute, before the person gets a task, he needs something else. He needs a situation that needs to be done. Then we could say that's his task. In other words, if everything in the universe is perfect, right, then obviously there's nothing that remains to be done. So there's no task. There's nothing. When we say that there's a task, it always means that something must be done. But in order for something to be done, something has to be imperfect. And therefore it can be perfected in some way, whatever it is. If the task is to take this chair, move it to the other place, then this chair has to be here, not there, right? If the task is to build a house, then there has to be a spot where there are no houses standing, and so on. Task always, rather, there must be a situation that has a deficiency in some sort, and then the task can address itself to that deficiency and correct that deficiency. So therefore, there must be a situation of chesaron, and therefore there can be a task. So, the Nivra is the first condition, it must be a being. The second condition, there must be a situation. And the third condition, there must be a task of some sort. The fourth condition is there must be an emtsoi. There must be a means to accomplish the task. How do I do this task? Fine, I have a job to do to correct the situation. But how do I do this job? I need a means, a method, an emtsoi, in order to get the job done. So man must be given a method, means to the end, which is the completion of the task. So that's the fourth condition, right, is the emtsoi. The fifth condition is that man must have free will. He must be able to freely do the task or not do the task. It has to be up to him. Obviously, because the completion of the task must be attributed to him. It has to be as a result of his actions. He gets the credit. And if the Bereshit forces man to do it, see, back to the old story. So what was the whole point of the task to begin with? Anyway, he's not responsible. And anyway, he's always a receiver. So therefore, an Odom must have Bechira. That's why a person has to have Bechira, free will. That's the fifth condition. Then there's one more condition. A person must be given a Yetzirah and a Yetzirah, an evil inclination and a good inclination. So you'll ask me, what does he need inclinations for? Right? He's got everything else. Right? The answer is that since it's difficult to do the task, because man is either inclined to do the task or not do the task, it's possible for a person to sit back and say, look, I'm not interested in the whole business. Get me out of it. I won't even involve myself in that task. So therefore the Roshim gives him drives, inclinations, that force him to engage in the task, but doesn't force him which to do. But you must be involved. You know what it's like? It's like there's a boxing match going on. and there's an arena, right? And then there's some big boxer who wants to take on any contender, you know? So the person will say, look, I'm not interested in knocking him out or being knocked out. I'm not interested in that job, you know? Leave me out of the arena. So you take the person, you force him into the arena. Now it's up to him if he's going to knock the guy out or not, right? But he's forced into the arena. He has no choice of being outside the arena. Although in the arena, it's up to him what happens. The same idea. The ideas of inclinations force you to do the task or not to do the task. They force you into the arena, the mahoma, the conflict. Will I do the task or will I not do the task? But they don't force you which side of the task to do. So in that way, a person cannot potter himself. He can't say, I don't want to have anything to do with it. He needs that push into the arena. So therefore, the Roshim sends him a Yetzer, a Yetzer Tov, in order to put him into what's called conflict, Milchoma, war. And as a result of that conflict or Milchoma, or war, he now must engage in battle. But it's up to him if he wants to win or not. You see? So we've now gone through the ideas of what constitutes the requirements for Ilm Hazeh. The idea of a Nivra, must be a being. There must be not only a being, but there must be a being. There must be a situation. There has to be a task. There has to be a method or means of accomplishing the task, right? There has to be free will, and there has to be inclinations that force you into the idea of task. This is the general structure. Now, these are general ideas of Ilm Hazeh. And of course, each idea is now fulfilled in a certain way. And then now you understand why Ilm Hazeh looks this way. Why it has Yitzharas and Yitzhatevs. Why it has Bechira. Why men have free will. You understand why certain things happen. What are situations. You understand why there are mitzvahs now and so on. Each one is merely one particular requirement that Ilm Hazeh needs. We know that the Rebbe Shlom, if you recall, created beings, and he created two kinds of beings. One is beings that are finite, but they're perfect, and those were the Malachim, right? The spiritual universe. And we know that the Rebbe Shlom also created beings that were imperfect, but were supposed to be perfected by themselves, right? And if they were, they would be even greater than the beings that were born, or rather created perfect. And this is Adam, right? We know that from previous shiur. Okay? Right now I'm trying to explain certain ideas of what the situation is. We know that. In other words, we know that different kinds of beings, two different kinds of statuses, right? And the malachim, the ruchnistic beings are one status where they are created exactly the way they should be at the outset, which is perfect. And that man was created, of course, imperfect, and his job is to reach perfection. And not only him, but the universe with him. And the perfection that he would reach would be even greater than the Ruchnistic universe, right? Okay. But the question really is two kind of questions. First of all, what is that chassan in man? Right now we've been talking in general terms the whole time. A chassan, a deficiency. But what is that deficiency in man? Number one. Right? And the second idea is, how do we understand man's deficiency? There are two ways of saying somebody is created deficient and has to strive for perfection, right? One is by saying that he was created deficient, right? And he strives and he actually changes as time goes on. His being changes, right? So he starts off imperfect and he actually changes to perfection. Then there's another way of saying that a person is created perfect, but he's giving interferences in experiencing that perfection. And what we really do is merely remove the interferences, and lo and behold, he's back what he used to be. You see the difference? Mm-hmm. Two ways of looking at it. You see? One is that he was created imperfect, right? And therefore, what happens is that his imperfection must be removed, and he now becomes perfect. But that's a change in the very being itself. Is that what's meant by the fact that man has to strive for perfection? Or nay? Man was really created perfect. But he was given interferences in experiencing that perfection. And his job is to remove the interferences. Mainly he would be perfect. See? So the question is, which is it? And the second kasha is, what is the chassan? whichever way it is, what is the chesed? Okay? The answer to that is, since it says Ein Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh, is no such thing new under the sun, obviously the direction is that man was created perfect. And what he was given was obstacles, interferences, with experiencing his perfection. And it is those interfering obstacles which must be removed. That is the nature of the kind of imperfection he has, not the other one. Because the other one would mean that he's a new being. And as such, as far being new being, right? He now has to change his being? No, that's not the way it was. Because the Rebbe Hashem created in one instant of time, with time itself, right? Everything that would be exists besides himself. Nothing new is created, nothing. Everything was created at that instant in time, okay? So therefore, man was created perfect. But what man was done was he was given imperfections, meaning that he does not experience his perfections because he cannot. He's got obstacles, things, impediments, interferences, which is stopping him from experiencing his own perfection. This is the status of how we really look at things, okay? So the question remains, of course, is what is the real perfection of man? And the answer to that is that the universe, the physical universe, is the imperfection. Now, man in his perfect state is called the neshama. The neshama is perfect. You see? There is no deficiency in the neshama. The neshama is very much like the Rebbe Nishlam. It's perfect. And it is. Chelek l'kamimal. It's part of the Rebbe Nishlam, from above, which is a statement Chazal use, right? So therefore, the neshama, which is man, is perfect. What the Rebbe Nishlam did is we took that neshama elyona, which is sholem, and he put it into a physical body, which is imperfect. He put it into a body which is imperfect, and that body itself is in a universe which is imperfect. He put it in what's called material substance, chume, gashmius. And that gashmius is the obstacle or the interfering factor that does not allow man to experience his own perfection. Now you begin to understand the needs for a physical universe, because what man needs is an interfering or obstacle, so therefore he needs another kind of universe that's going to interfere with his shlemus. That's why you begin to have the need of a physical universe. You could have had only the spiritual universe. But since man was created perfect, where's the obstacle going to come from? So it would come from another universe by being inserted in that other universe. And that universe, of course, is the physical universe. And that physical universe now serves as his obstacle, okay? It serves as his impediment or interference with the Margish's Shlemus. But wait a minute, what is his Shlemus? His Shlemus is what? Vikus, being in contact with his source, right? That is his Shlemus. Remember what we said in the first half of this year? That his Shlemus is the Rabbeinu Shlom, that he is Margish. As soon as man is put into a physical universe, bam, he's not margish anything anymore. No, he's not margish the Rebbeinu Shlom anymore. He doesn't see the Rebbeinu Shlom, and he does not experience the Rebbeinu Shlom from within him. You see, that's what the physical universe does. It stops man from connecting to his source. It stops man from dvikus. That's exactly what it did. Before the neshama comes down here, it's mizdabik in the Rebbeinu Shlom, right? Vegas. But it's mizdabik in the Rebbeinu Shlom with namad iksufa. There's a murdig embarrassment because it didn't work to give back to the Rebbeinu Shlom. It's merely a reception of the Rebbeinu Shlom himself. There's no turning that desire to give, the desire to receive, to desire to give, right? So the man has to come down here. But by coming down here, automatically he doesn't margish the Rebbeinu Shlom anymore. So man's placed into a physical universe to stop him from seeing and feeling and experiencing the Rebbeinu Shlom, which he did before he got down here. And now he's got to work on this universe to be masig him all over again. And to the degree that he's masig him here, That's the amount of masigim back there. You see? Now you begin to understand the general schema of what's going on. But it has to be much more elaborated on. And that will continue with that in next week's shurim. If you recall, the Rebbeinu Shem created two kinds of nivroim, two kinds of beings. The first being is finite, but it's perfect. Perfect in the sense that it was created at the exact level that it had to have been created. These, of course, are the malachim, the angels, the spiritual universe. The second kind of being that the Rebbeinu Shem created is Adam, man. Man is finite, but man was created chosser. Chosser means that it somehow is created deficient. And the whole purpose of what man's supposed to do is to be mashlim that chesar, to go from the state of deficiency to the state of perfection. Now one can ask several questions. First of all, until now we've been speaking in generalities. Generalities in the sense of we know that the situation of the Bria is chesaron, right? Chesaron means that hesti yehudoi, that the Rebbeinu Shem has concealed some aspect of his yehudoi, right? And therefore there's a chesaron in the Bria. But what we want to do now is discuss more objectively, more concretely, exactly what is the chesaron in real terms? And how does the fact that the Rebbeinu Shem hides his yehudoi, how does that really happen? What is Master Yehudoi? So the first question that we want to go into is, what is the chesaron in the Bria? What really is the chesaron? Of course, the ultimate chesaron is the fact that the yichud of the Rebbeinu Shem is hidden. But what is the means or the way that the yichud of the Rebbeinu Shem is hidden? So what is the chesaron really? Also, I mentioned last time the question, how was man created? Was he created chosser and then he has to be mashlim himself? Or was he created sholem, perfect? And then something interferes with man experiencing his perfection, and man's purpose is to remove that obstacle, and therefore he then returns to his original state of shlemus. That's the second, the two ways when we talk about chosser and sholem. Was man created deficient and then he has to strive to make himself perfect? Or was he created perfect, then made to feel deficient, and he's got to remove that interference of his perfection? And when he removes that obstacle, he then will begin to experience again the perfection. So that's the second kind of question. And the third idea is, when we say that the Rebbeinu Shem is Hesti Yehudah, what does that really mean? How is the Rebbeinu Shem really Nistar from the Bria? What are the exact circumstances that really hide the Rebbeinu Shem in the Bria? These are the ideas that I want to go on today. And the truth is that this brings us to the entire idea of why was man created in the physical universe? Why was man created with a guf? What the Rebbeinu Shem did is he created the neshama. The neshama in itself is a perfect being in the sense that it is masig. It experiences the Rebbeinu Shloim. And the truth is that before the Neshamas came down to this world, all of them were experiencing the Rebbeinu Shloim. All the Neshamas were in a state of Dvekus before they came down to this Bria. They don't reach it only after. They were in a state of Dvekus even before they came down to the Bria. In other words, if you recall, the essential idea of Dvekus is that the Neshama comprehends or experiences the Rebbeinu Shloim as a part of itself and feels the Rebbeinu Shloim as its source or its root, and to that extent that it feels the Rebbeinu Shloim, to that extent it's masig or comprehends the unity that the Rebbeinu Shloim is really the Neshama itself. And of course the more it experiences the Rebbeinu Shloim, the more it feels the Shlemus of God, therefore it's Mishtalem, it itself becomes more perfect because it feels itself as part of God, and that part itself which it experiences with, which is the Rebbeinu Shloim, is perfect because God is perfect. Therefore it becomes more perfect. In other words, it becomes more and more aware that God is itself, and to that extent that it becomes aware, it becomes more mishtalim, more perfect. So the neshama, before it gets down here, is really experiencing the yichudai. But what's wrong? What's wrong is that it's experiencing this yichudai with embarrassment, with nam niksufa. That was the whole point. That it gets this experience of dveikus even before it comes down here, but it's experiencing this state of dveikus with nam niksufa. And the Rebbeinu Shlom wants to remove that nam niksufa. So what does the Rebbeinu Shlom do? He takes the neshama and he puts it into a body, a guf. He takes the neshama and he inserts it into a body, a human body. In other words, the material substance of the Odom is presented or given by his father and mother, because there are three partners to every person. His father and mother provide the material substance, the chumer, the gashmi, the physical. The Rebbeinu Shlom provides the neshama. And in that sense, they're all partners. So the Rebbeinu Shlom provides the neshama and he puts it into the guf. And of course, for the guf, it's a terrible experience. What happens when the neshama goes into the guf? Several very important events happen. The neshama goes into the guf and all of a sudden, it ceases to experience the Rebbeinu Shlom. Why? The guf itself is a very concrete, a very thick, a very obtuse kind of object. The guf does not itself allow any kind of... It doesn't allow, because of its chumah, because it's so gross, it doesn't allow the neshama in the guf to experience the Rebbeinu Shlom. So all of a sudden the neshama finds itself cut off from the experience that it had previously, and that is dveikus. It doesn't experience the Rebbeinu Shlom anymore. Gone is the feeling of closeness or experiencing the Rebbeinu Shlom as part of itself. That's the first thing that happens to the guf as a result of the fact that, or rather happens to the neshama as a result of the fact that it's inserted into the guf. Its feeling of the Rebbeinu Shlom is lost. So the dveikus is gone. The second thing that happens to the neshama is that it now loses its sense of its own nature. It doesn't know that it is a soul. All there is now is a self that's conscious of everything else, but of its own nature. In other words, everybody here is a neshama which is looking out of a body. The fact that the neshama is embedded in the body prevents you from being masik the Rebbeinu Shlom. That's the first thing. And the second thing, it prevents you from actually experiencing yourself, the real neshama. So all you're left with is a sense of a self which is in your body, looking out, seeing the world. That's all you're left with. You now don't experience the Rebbeinu Shlom, you don't experience your true nature as a spiritual being. All you have left is a consciousness, a self. And yourself is aware of yourself as a real being. That's all that's left. So you have those two ideas. The fact that the neshama does not masik the Rebbeinu Shlom anymore. And the second idea, it doesn't masik its own nature because it's tangled in the chumah, the gashmius. This is the repercussion of taking the neshama and tying it into sort of a prison, into the guf itself. So the neshama experiences not its true nature, but it's aware of itself as a true being, as a being, a self. Now, the neshama also is aware of other beings. It looks around the world and it sees a physical universe. So it's aware of other beings and that it is distinct from those other beings. This is what the neshama sees. But interestingly enough, what is apparent to the neshama is the illusion of many beings. The neshama looks out of the body in which it's imprisoned in and looks around the world and it recognizes that it is a being in itself. And it sees other people. It sees other things. It sees a multiplicity of many, many billions of different objects and things. And it sees a multiplicity of forces. Different things are behaving and moving different things. This is what the neshama experiences. A ribui metzius, a multiplicity or diversity or plurality of beings. And a ribui koichus, a multiplicity of many different forces. That each being has a force in its own right, that can walk, it can move objects, that actually has potency in this world. So that's the third thing that happens to the neshama. The first, again, was the fact that it doesn't experience the Ribbono Shel Olam anymore. The second, it doesn't experience its true nature anymore. All it is left is with consciousness. That's all it has. That's you looking out at me. Is this consciousness looking at me? And the third thing it experiences is this incredible array of many different beings and forces, which gives it the illusion that there are many, many different things in this Bria. It gives it the illusion of Hesti Yechudoi, that it is no, is not just the Ribbono Shel Olam, but many, many different things. This is what the neshama so far is experiencing in the body. The loss of contact with the Ribbono Shel Olam, the loss of contact with its own nature, and the illusion of incredible amount of multiplicity all around in the Bria, either in terms of being or in terms of force. So therefore it now believes that there are many beings in the world, because every child that grows up believes that there are many, many different things. I'm talking about a real human being now that grows up. This is the attitude, that there are many, many different things. It is a person, it's a being, and there are many other beings besides it. Besides that, you feel that you want to strive. You feel that you have a will. The neshama, or the person, wills. What is a will? Nothing. A will is nothing more than that faculty of a person that wants, that desires, wishes, wills. Okay? And whatever you will want, that's what you're going to strive to get. So you have the self, which is the neshama. It has a will, right? Which is the aspect of man that wants, that wills, wants, desires. And you will strive in accordance with what you want. In other words, whatever the content of the will, that will be your motive. In other words, the definition of motive is the content of your will. Whatever you want, whatever that is, that becomes the content of your will, and that's what you strive for. Now, we've gone to different aspects of what the body does to the neshama. It does one more thing, fourth thing, which is really very difficult for the neshama to accept in that sense. All of a sudden you take a spiritual being in the neshama and you put it into a body. But that body itself has tremendous amount of needs and drives and urges. These drives don't come from the neshama, the desire to eat, to drink, to sleep and so on. These desires or taivas don't come from the neshama. They come from the physical body. They are created as an aspect of the body. And the neshama, which is the consciousness in the body, all of a sudden experiences these drives. So all of a sudden, it's experiencing drives. You are not the drive. Let's say a person feels hungry. He is not the hunger. All of a sudden, you who are conscious, I'm hungry. I feel my stomach is going back and forth, contracting and expanding, and that creates the sensation of hunger or drive. So the consciousness in the body, which is the neshama, all of a sudden is margish. Tremendous amount of different feelings and urges and desires. Or in one word that describes it all, taiva. That's what taiva is. Taiva is all the urges, the needs, the drives. As a result, that's emanating from the physical body. The neshama all of a sudden feels that. Now, these drives are very strong. They demand fulfillment, or else they're going to keep bothering you. They'll produce pain. So therefore, obviously, what does the neshama want to do? It wants to fulfill those drives. So the content of the will, what does the neshama desire, which is its motive, now becomes that which is it's experiencing, namely to fulfill those needs and drives. Because if it doesn't do that, there's going to be a lot of pain involved. So the neshama now strives to fulfill all these drives by going out to work and so on, getting money. All this is nothing more than the striving of the person, which is really the neshama, which is experiencing the guf. The neshama is feeling this, and it goes and strives in order to fulfill all these desires that it is experiencing because of the body, not because of itself. But since you don't know that you are a neshama, you think that you are the body. That's the point. The illusion is you think you are the physical body, and that your physical body has a consciousness of its own. It doesn't. you, whoever you are neshamas, all in a body looking out. But you've lost, disconnected with the Rabbanu Shlom. You've now not only disconnected with the Rabbanu Shlom, you're not even in contact with your own nature. So you think you're some aspect of the body. Not only that, but the third idea is you see this incredible amount of illusion of many beings and forces. And the fourth idea is you are now subject to an assault by the needs and drives of the body. So you don't know, the neshama doesn't know what hits it. But what can it do? It can only then do what? Its main motive now becomes to fulfill the needs that it's experiencing. So it now goes out and tries to strive. And the major motive of the Adam, which means the major motive of the neshama, of course it doesn't know it's a neshama, it thinks it's an Adam, the major motive is what? To fulfill the needs and the drives. That becomes the major motive. To be mamalit taivas. Okay? This is sort of like a scenario that's building up. So you begin to realize the relationship between the neshama and the guf, and what the guf does to the neshama, as a result of the fact that the neshama is entangled in the guf. So the neshama, in other words, begins experiencing tremendous amount of drives, as I mentioned. And this is an aspect of the guf, not of the neshama. And the major motive of all the strivings, as I mentioned, now becomes to fulfill these taivas, to get rid of these drives, and therefore the neshama now begins pursuing through the medium of the body, physical body, it now begins assuming this purpose, and that is to fulfill its taivas. This is what the Rabbanu Shlom wants, that the neshama is disconnected from the Rabbanu Shlom, and it comes under the illusion of multiplicity. It's not magish, it's nature, and it should be assaulted by drives and taivas. And this should force the neshama to begin striving. Okay? This is the beginning of the scenario. Those taivas which incline the neshama to fulfill it can be looked at as the Yetzirah. Those drives that force the neshama to fulfill the wants of the body can be looked on as a striving of the Yetzirah, the inclination that forces the neshama to do the bidding of the body. One more aspect of the neshama. The neshama can do everything the body can do outside the body. The neshama sees, it knows, it smells, it hears, it can do everything. It doesn't need the body. But when the Rabbanu Shlom takes the neshama, not only that, it does it in a very different way. It doesn't have different organs for all the faculties that the human body can do. It's all the faculties are in one organ, namely itself, the neshama. The neshama is poshut, just like the Rabbanu Shlom is, if you recall. Just like God has no diversity in organs, there's only one organ that gives rise to all faculties, namely the being itself. The neshama is the same way. But when the Rabbanu Shlom takes the neshama and forces it into the body, it now can only see through the eyes. It doesn't see through its own eyes. It can only see through the eyes. That's the gzera. That now it can only do all the faculties according to the physical mechanism, not its own nature. So in other words, if a person becomes blind, his eyes, the physical eyes, you cannot see. The neshama cannot see. I can see without the eyes. But part of the idea of the neshama being in the body is it cannot perform these functions because of its nature. It can only perform the functions via the physical mechanism, the physical eyes. And if those eyes go blind, it's all over, there's no sight. If the person can hear, there's no hearing and so on. If the brain gets damaged, then the neshama cannot think. It doesn't need the brain to think, but it's locked into the physical mechanism of the brain and it can only think through the brain. If the brain ceases to think, in case of retarded or brain damage or whatever, then the person cannot think anymore. That's the gzar din, that the neshama is completely included in the mechanism of the body. You know what it's very similar to? It's like a person, there's like a robot costume, and the person goes into the robot costume, okay? And you can't see anything out of it, hear anything, but the robot's got television eyes, right? It's got hands, and inside you can manipulate. It's like you're in a tank, okay? And the tank has, robots on the moon, very large, and you can be inside and manipulate the arms, and you can see outside from television cameras. It's the same idea. With the neshama in the goof, it's like this person is in this very large robot on the moon, and it can control everything outside by the robot, but he can only receive stimuli, he can only receive light and so on via the robot itself. So he can only see through the TV cameras in the robot. He can't see what it is, even though he can see, but he can only see through the physical mechanism of the robot. He can only hear through the loudspeakers of the robot. Okay? It's the same idea that the neshama is tied into the body. It cannot exercise its faculties by virtue of its own nature. It can only do them by the mechanism of the body. It's the same idea as the robot. Therefore, the neshama is completely a prisoner of the guf. And it experiences the drives of the guf and the strivings, and it now begins trying to fulfill that. This, so far, is the status quo of the situation the neshama finds itself into. So this is an understanding so far of what the consequences have arisen as a result of the fact that the neshama has been forced into the body, right? And we've seen five. The first is that it loses its dveikus to the Ribbono Shel Olam, which it had previously under the conditions of Na'am Diksufa, but it now loses that. Second, it loses its sense of its own nature. All remains is with a consciousness of self. Right? The third is that it views all other beings, because the whole physical universe is pure. The whole physical universe is gross matter. You don't see the Ribbono Shel Olam in the entire physical universe. If you were in the spiritual universe, you would see the Ribbono Shel Olam through everything, all over. Through every being would manifest the Ribbono Shel Olam out. But in the physical universe, it's opaque. It's an obstacle to any kind of Yehudo or the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's Hester. The physical universe is the Hest of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You see, that's what I'm arriving at. In addition, not only does it perceive Ribui Metzias from Ribui Kirchis and so on, it perceives the tremendous amount of drives that it thinks it has, but it's not. It's only because it's in the goof. It's the goof's contribution, not the neshama. But you don't know you're in the neshama anymore. You think your consciousness only from the goof. And the fifth idea was the fact that neshama now can perform all its faculties only through the guf and nothing else. So if a person gets harmed, then some aspect of the neshama ceases to operate, because it cannot operate as a result of its nature, only through the guf. And if you're having the mechanism, that's it. Like the guy in the robot with the television screens went off. He can't see anymore. Even though if he went out of the robot, he could see. This is so far what we're talking about, the consequences of the neshama in the guf. Now the question is, what have we remained with? We see that all of a sudden the neshama in the guf, thinking that it's a body, is now striving to fulfill taivas, correct? I mean, this is really where it's winding up. Well, then what happens with the avoda and so on? How do we understand now the tir and the avoda? Where does all this fit? Okay. Let's go back to the task. Remember we said that the situation. The situation of the Bria means that there's Hesti Yehudi all over the Bria. Right? It's Hesti Chudo. We do not see the presence of the Bershom all of the Bria. Right? This is the situation. But it's interesting enough that if the Hesti Chudo is basically the physical universe, then there's a million different ways that there could be Hesti Chudo. In other words, for instance, I'll give you an example. A person who is rich, he thinks that he earned his money, right? And he doesn't give to charity and so on. So the Hesti Chudo of himself, in his framework, so he thinks that, of course, he's the only one. A person who is poor, okay, he again thinks he's the only one because he complains, why is he in this matzav? He complains against the Ribbono Shel Olam. A person who is healthy, he thinks, or, you know, physically very well developed, he thinks that he's somebody. In other words, the idea of Ribui Metzias and Ribui Kirchis has millions and millions of different ways. Millions and millions of different ways you could think that there is everything else but the Ribbono Shel Olam. You see? So what the Ribbono Shel Olam did is he took the entire physical universe in all its billions of different ways of Hester, because there's many billions of different Metzias and Kirchas, right? And he split it up. He divided it into different areas. He divided the entire situation of Hester, which means the physical universe, the different situations in the physical universe, he divided up. In other words, wealth is one kind of situation in the physical universe, poverty is another, sickness is another, health is another, right? Royalty is another, there's many different, intelligence is another, form of Hester, okay? So in other words, he divided the entire physical universe in many, many different ways. What he did was he took one Jew and he assigned him to one situation. He said, I want you to Megali Yehuda in that area. So what he did is he took all the Jews and he assigned them to all the different situations in the Bria that have Hester, and he gave one Jew each area of Hester. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's your area that you have to reveal my unity. If you're a rich man, you've got to reveal my unity through your riches. If you're a poor man, through your poverty, health, intelligence, I don't care what situation. Every situation in the universe, everybody, that's why every situation is unique. There's no two people who have the exact same situation in life. In other words, what the Bereshit did, strange enough, is he divided the entire physical universe that has all the Hester, right? And he took one Jew and he appointed him to each area. So he took the total area of Hester and he divided into general areas, right? Then he took a Jew and he said, I want you to have a task, a general task. Your general task is to fix that general area. You see? So each Jew has a certain general area that he's supposed to masakin. In other words, again, the wealthy man has to masakin the Hester in the area of wealth. That even though he has all the money and he thinks he made it all, it's only the Ribbono Shel Olam that is given to him, and so on. Other people have to do it in their areas. So it comes out that every Jew, what determines his life situation, meaning his body equipment, how he's born, and the environment he finds himself into, and the future nisyonos he has, is all determined by the particular general area of Hester Yehudoi that he has to reveal. You see? Now you know why or what determines every particular kind of situation that a person is in. His situation, his body that he's born in, the kind of parents he has in wealth or whatever, and the kinds of events that happen to him that give him nisyonos are all determined by the particular general area of Hester Yehudoi that he has to masakin. Now, it comes out that every Jew has a general area that they have to masakin. That's why no Jew can duplicate the actions of another, because you have your peculiar area that you have to masakin. Somebody else doesn't have that area. And only you can masakin your life situation, because nobody can duplicate your life situation. So in other words, the total area of Hester Yehudoi has now been subdivided into general areas, and each Jew has been assigned one general area in this whole physical universe to Megali Yehudoi, right? So it comes out that if all Jews together, or rather, let's take a look at the individual. If one individual becomes a tzaddik, right? It comes out that he has been Megali Yehudoi in his area. So therefore, that is his chus. What happens if he does that veras? So it comes out he's mekalkel that area. Not only does he not megali yehudei, but he even masti yehudei even more in his particular area. What happens if all Klai Yisrael does their job? So in other words, Klai Yisrael collectively has now been mesaken the entire area of Hester Yehudoi. Now you see how everybody in Klai Yisrael fits in exactly in a specific, unique area. Because everybody has been assigned a general area to work on, right? Megali Yehudoi. So it comes out that if a person does his area, he does the mitzvahs and so on, he does what's called tikkun yechidi, he's mesaken that specific area. And if Klai Yisrael, all Jews together do the job, they have done the complete Gil Yehudoi of all the Hester, which means Gil Yehudoi in every situation in the physical universe. Okay, you see how it works? The distribution or division of the total Hester area into different areas in terms of the physical universe, right? Then the Ribbono Shel Olam has divided the tasks, one task into many tasks, and assigned them to each Jew, right? This is so far what's shaping up. And that determines the life situation of each individual. Why everything happens to him the way it does. Because he has the Megali Yehudoi that way. Now, the idea is, but wait a minute, how does that work? How is the person Megali Yehudoi in his physical area? Well, we know that the person strives because he's receiving all these impulses, these urges from the body, correct? So we know he's going to strive because he wants to fulfill all these needs and drives. So what the Ribbono Shel wants, what he did, is the next Merdik Zah. The Ribbono Shel took 613 tasks that correspond to every way you can strive. When you eat, the Ribbono Shel has benching. You see, every drive, everything you can do, all the areas of your strivings, there's a mitzvah that corresponds exactly to that striving. Okay? So the Ribbono Shel says, don't strive to fulfill your needs because you think you're a self. Strive to do the mitzvah, which you'll notice takes the physical act and makadish it, which means that you do it because the Ribbono Shel wants you to do it. You see? So it comes out that all strivings are basically divided into 613 areas. That's why do you think all the mitzvahs are so comprehensive in all your areas of life? Because that's what the Ribbono Shel did. You have a certain area of your life, you strive in that complete area. Everybody has their area, they strive in that area, right? But the strivings are the same. We all eat, we all do many things, but we do it in our area. So the Ribbono Shel took 613 areas, which include all our strivings, which is common to all men, and every person in his area has to strive not for the physical fulfillment of the desires because he thinks that he's a self and therefore it's okay. He has to do the strivings through the design of the mitzvah. And part of the mitzvah is that the mitzvah itself is made yichudi because there's always a sacrifice involved. And also part of the mitzvah is the kavona, that I am doing the mitzvah, there is no self-interest. I'm doing it only because the Ribbono Shel is the only self. Okay? So we see now that the strivings themselves are regulated or must filter through the emtsui called the mitzvah. In other words, you want to strive to fulfill a need? Go and strive. But strive to fulfill that need through the mitzvah. You want to eat? Go and eat. But eat through the vehicle of the mitzvah, which means making a bracha before. While you're eating, you mechaven to do the nachas ruach of the Ribbono Shel, and you bench afterward. Notice that the Ribbono Shel has taken the very act itself, the physical act, and has converted it through a mitzvah, where you now take the physical act and you now do it only in response to the fact that the Ribbono Shel is the only real self. The Meila, you have no interest in terms of self. You see? This is the culmination of the Shulman Avoida. That's what the Ribbono Shel has done. He's taken all the areas of the physical universe, which correspond to all the areas of Hesti Yehudei. He's divided them. He's given each Jew a certain area, which means that you have a particular life situation that you're born in terms of your body, in terms of your environment, in terms of the events you go through, right? Every Jew has different. What he's done then is that every Jew strives in the same manner because everybody's got the same physical urges, right? It's the same body. What he's done is he's taken 613 mitzvahs, which encompass all the areas that you will strive. And he's forced you to do the physical act, not through the striving of fulfillment of the desire, but through the striving through the vehicle of the mitzvah. So he's converted the mitzvah physical act, the physical act, into a mitzvah physical act. So therefore you no more do the striving, for instance eating, because you do it because you believe you're a self and you want to fulfill your desires. You now do it because you do it for the Ribbono Shel, because he's the only being or self. So therefore the entire mitzvah is done for that. The striving then takes on a kedusha, or the idea that it's done only for the Ribbono Shel. And of course you then complete your area. When every Jew completes the area, then you have what's called a tikkun haklali. I mean, the entire Klal Yisrael has fulfilled the area of Hesti Yehudai throughout every physical instance in the Bria. Okay, now you see the way it shapes up. And this, of course, is physically manifested. That's the idea of the Neshama in the Guf, that the strivings are physical, the mitzvah is physical, and what you do is you take the mitzvah and you strive with the mitzvah, and you give that fulfillment of needs and drives. You do it only because the Ribbono Shel wants you to eat and so on and so forth. So you've taken the actual physical act itself, and your motive is not because you want to do it, because you are also self. Your motive is because the Ribbono Shel wants you to do it. So the physical act itself is now dedicated to the Ribbono Shel. And therefore that area of Hesti Yechudi, which is that striving, that particular physical form, is now the Ribbono Shelo's. That's the idea of the Hesti, of the situation being divided, the tasks being divided, and in every particular task itself, you have the strivings, and the mitzvahs correspond to those strivings. So it comes out that via the physical universe, via all the urges where you're forced to engage, the main idea is don't do it because of self. Do it because of the Ribbono Shel'olam, and that's exactly what the mitzvah is designed for you. And all the mitzvahs correspond to all the different ways you can strive. Because if you recall, you have mitzvahs in ownership, you have mitzvahs in maisim, remember all the mitzvahs in the different areas? Every mitzvah in all the Shisha, Sidvei, Mishnah, right, is hits some aspect of you. So therefore all the mitzvahs taka correspond to all strivings in all the different areas of Olam Hazeh, which is all the areas of Hesti Yechudi. And each Jew has his own assignment, and when all Klal Yisrael is masakin or does their mitzvahs, it comes out that the entire physical universe is niskan. It is now, has a tikkun. The idea of what the body does to the neshama, the idea that the neshama strives because it experiences urges, the idea that every neshama now strives in the same way but in different areas, right? The idea that all areas have been divided, given to each neshama, and the mitzvahs correspond to all the areas of strivings, and you take the strivings and dedicate it to the Ribbono Shel Olam because he's a self, and not dedicated to yourself because you think you're a self. This is more or less what we've talked about till now. What happens as a result? Well, there's one koyach the neshama has. You know what that is? The neshama can actually dematerialize the physical body. That's called zikuch. The neshama has the power, when the Ribbono Shel Olam puts it in to the guf, the neshama has the power, it's such a strong being, that it actually just dematerializes the body. So it's almost like you're putting, it's, if we did dematerialize the body, what happened was the body would be completely glass. I mean, give a mashal. Where the neshama would still be masik or dovet in the Ribbono Shel Olam. The body couldn't stop it. The neshama is such a powerful being, the connection between it and the Ribbono Shel Olam is so powerful that even if you took the neshama and you put it in the body and therefore like you put it into an obstacle, it's like you take a person and you put it into a darkened room, right? You put them in a room and it's pitch black. All of a sudden, there's no light coming in. And there's no windows, no doors. So what does that person do? He can begin breaking the walls in order to get out. The neshama can break the walls of the body by changing the actual matter itself to become extremely fine, like glass, where all of a sudden the neshama shines out and the Ribbono Shel Olam, of course, comes back in. Wait. And the Ribbono Shel Olam comes back in, and therefore the neshama is now mezakech the guf. Zikuch haguf means to purify the body. The neshama can do it. It's that powerful. But what did the Ribbono Shel Olam do? The Ribbono Shel Olam, of course, he took the neshama and he said, like he did to the moon, Lechi lech umatis atzmecha, go and diminish yourself. The Ribbono Shel Olam takes the neshama and forces it into the body and prevents it from changing the physical form of the body. Prevents it. That's why it cannot do what I'm saying it could do. It cannot do that. It could have originally, that's how strong it was. But the Ribbono Shel Olam told the neshama, it's Mesaveh, Goyza, of course, that the neshama does not have the power to do that anymore. He handicapped it in that way, because he wants the neshama to be in the body. There is one thing that's supposed to give the neshama back its power. You know what that is? The mitzvah. Every time the neshama does a mitzvah, it gets a certain aspect of itself more powerful. And as a result of that, it can mezakech the guf. Now forget about the fact that we don't see it happening. That was the result of Adam Rishon's chet, which I'll talk about later on, right? But it was supposed to have done this. So in other words, Adam Rishon, he took an neshama, put it into the guf, he was a prisoner there, right? Experiencing many different things, and it had mitzvahs, or he had a mitzvah, whatever. And he was supposed to take that mitzvah, strive, and then turn it to the Ribbono Shel Olam and not to himself. Okay? So what happened by Adam is that had he done the mitzvah, his neshama would have immediately purified the body, and his body would have been, I imagine, like would be like glass, where you could look at the body and you'd see the neshama. There's no obstacle anymore. This is what the neshama would have done to the body through the emtzui of the mitzvah. In other words, why does the mitzvah do this? Because when a person does a physical act for the Rabbeinu Shlom, what is he really saying? He's saying that this physical act has no existence by itself. It's part of the yichud of the Rabbeinu Shlom. So what the Rabbeinu Shlom does is mida keneged mida. Since you realize that the physical universe is merely an illusion in the sense that it's really only part of me, that physical universe will now change to reflect me. That's why when the mitzvah, which is nothing more than a striving of the body in this physical world, what the person is really saying is that this entire physical idea and strivings is only the Rabbeinu Shlom. Therefore, the Rabbeinu Shlom, as a result of that, will remove the physicalness, the grossness of the body, and therefore that physical aspect disappears. In any case, the neshama could have done that zikuch, but because of the chet of Adam Rishon, it lost that power. And I'll talk about it at a future time, because that has significance of what really misa or death is, and why there's a resurrection of the dead, and so on. What happens is that the neshama, through the mitzvahs, it has the power back, and it's mezakech the guf, proportionate to the amount of mitzvahs it does. The more mitzvahs it does, the more it can purify the body. And you'll notice that when it purifies the body, what happens to the neshama? The obstacle is removed. So what happens to the neshama? It is now mizdavik back with the Rabbeinu Shlom. What prevents the neshama from coming in contact with its own nature and the Rabbeinu Shlom? The guf. If you can purify the guf, then what happens? There's no more obstacle. So the neshama now can again masik or feel the Rabbeinu Shlom or experience the Rabbeinu Shlom. So therefore the task of the person really is the mezakech the guf. That is the hester. The guf is the hester, and the neshama through the mitzvah is mezakech the guf, that's the task. And when it purifies the body, that's the giloy. Then all of a sudden it's megali yechudoy, because the Rabbeinu Shlom, it now experiences the Rabbeinu Shlom. Therefore it immediately becomes sholem, more perfect. It goes back to the original state of Vegas. Because what it did, it's like the man put in the room and he broke the walls down. Or else he somehow changed the walls into glass. Made it all into windows. So now he can see, even through a room. That's mamash what the neshama does. It makes the body be able to receive the Rabbeinu Shlom or go through it. So it's now again able to be mezdabik in the Rabbeinu Shlom. So it comes out that we now understand several ideas. The first idea is, what is the chesaron? And the answer is the chesaron is hester yichudoy, but now we understand how. The physical universe is that hester yichudoy. Okay? So that is the chesaron. The fact that neshama is in a physical universe. The idea that was the neshama created choser and then sholem, or sholem choser then sholem, we see that the neshama was created deficient, or rather first it was created perfect, given an obstacle to that. That's its deficiency, and after the deficiency, it now has to remove that deficiency, purify the body, and now it becomes again perfect. But when it becomes perfect, when it receives dveikus, the dveikus is now ayidei schus, because it deserves that, because it worked to remove the obstacle. So now when it receives the dveikus of the Rabbeinu Shlom, it no more feels the shame, because it receives, or it's now dovek in the Rabbeinu Shlom, which means that it purifies the body in the exact amount that it did mitzvahs. So if it did many mitzvahs, so the body is even more purified. And therefore it receives the Rabbeinu Shlom, experiences the Rabbeinu Shlom even more, but only by its own efforts. If it did less, then it receives the Rabbeinu Shlom, or is dabbing in the Rabbeinu Shlom, much less. Because the obstacle of the guf is still there. You see? So therefore we understand that the neshama was truly created perfect, and then given that deficiency of the body, which it must overcome through the mitzvah, and then it becomes again perfect because the body becomes purified. And we see also the exact expressions of Hester Yichudoy and so on, that all this is really the physical universe. And as a result of the entire physical universe, this is a situation that's created, where it has to work through the physical universe with the mitzvah, which is the striving in its particular area. All Klai Yisrael does mitzvahs and is mezakeh the entire physical universe, and it's mezakeh the physical universe. Not only is it purifying its own body, but it purifies the entire physical universe. That's why in Olam HaBa, you have again the physical universe, but in its purified form, where you will see the Ribbono Shel Olam in everything, in the car, if there are cars, whatever, and so on. You then see the essence of everything, mitoich the chomer, because that is what happens when the physical universe itself becomes purified. So therefore, we've come into an understanding of what happens to Neshama as a result of the drift, the experiences it goes through, why life situations happen to different Jews, the assignments of each Jew to a particular area of Hester in the physical universe, the 613 mitzvahs corresponding to all the strivings that each one has to do, the 613 mitzvahs in their areas, and the result in eventually zikuch haguf, which breaks the boundary, and you now mezdabek ayidei schus, because you only feel the Ribbono Shel Olam because you work for it. And the more you mezakich the guf, purify the body, the more you experience the Ribbono Shel Olam. The less, therefore it's only ayidei schus.